So welcome everyone for coming tonight. It is a little strange what we do here, isn't it? You know, cars zooming about, people rushing from here to there. Another holiday season upon us. Things become a little frenetic. Right? World, you know, we read the newspapers or watch the news, it's right, one bad thing after the other, right? Economic instability, endless wars, growing disparities between the rich and the poor, great economic difficulties in our own country, the world, a lot of unknowing. Climate, environment, right? It seems in every area there are significant problems and uncertainties, and as well as for many of us in our own life, in our personal lives, or in the lives of those we are connected with. There is suffering, and there is uncertainties, difficulties. And yet, what do? We come here and we sit. And then we walk. And then we sit. Right. And somebody might say, well, what kind of response is that to a world as it is? You know, why aren't we out there doing something, right, about it? And that's, that's a good question, isn't it? That's a deep question. Why is it when there's so much of what we've just talked about, and we could go on and on, not that we don't do things to help, but why do we choose to stop and to sit? And to basically do nothing, right? When the world seems to need so much something, why do we choose to do nothing? It's a deep issue for all of us. But I think there are good reasons. I think on one level, when there is such suffering in the world, and such suffering in human lives, and such meaninglessness in so many lives, and so much frenetic pursuit of things, right? For so many people, such a loss of capacity just to be happy and peaceful. Just as human beings. I mean, it's almost like that's become a lost art. Right. And so in a certain way, a learning to be happy, just with our simplest humanity, right? Just to be content with what it's like to just be a human being in this world and to take pleasure and joy in that which is around us. Sky, clouds, sun, flowers, water, fellow human beings, friends, pets. On and on, right? Our capacity to see, our capacity to hear. I mean, these are miraculous things, this life of ours. In the midst of the frenetic pursuit of externals that so seems to be so driving the world, I think this is a very radical kind of act. right? To do nothing. And to say, doing nothing can bring great happiness and peace. It is a kind of doing that I think is a very powerful counterweight to the energy that is trying to pull us around and along in this life. So that's one reason to cultivate this inner life, this inner peace, this inner happiness, this capacity to be content with what is, and to take joy in the simplicity of life. But I think our practice of stillness and mindfulness and looking deeply is also very meaningful, because there's great confusion in the world, right? And the way to remedy, quote unquote, the significant problems, right, that humanity faces, seems to be in the hands of people who disrespect one another, right? Who talk at one another, but no one's listening, right? And the answers that people come up with, while they may have a certain soundness to them, seem to be missing something. There's something deeper going on here, right, in this life, in this world at this time. And so I think our practice of pulling back, not only from the clamor of the external world, but also from the clamor of our own thoughts, clanging about, clashing about, to listen more deeply to ourselves and more deeply to others, perhaps will allow us to hear a deeper solution to what ails mankind, womankind, humankind, than is being presented as external solutions. Because I think there is a great sense for many people that something is wrong, right? You hear it all the time. And, you know, lots of people think they have the political answer. And they're very busy yelling it and shouting it and putting down everyone else who doesn't agree with them. But I think that also is symptomatic of that people are suffering, people are lost, people are frustrated, people are scared, people are angry, right? And they don't see a way of real, deep, profound transformation and healing and direction. I think this path that we're on, and again, we're not the only ones on it. I mean, lots of people are on it, of all different spiritual traditions and faith and non-faith, is significant. Sometimes you have to pull back, right? You have to step out of so you can see clearly, right? And so you can, you know, get outside the box, as they say. And in a certain way, our practice of non-doing, our practice of stillness, our practice of looking deeply, our practice of getting in touch with, I think will be very helpful to this world. And this world means, you know, each of us and those around us, our friends and family and our society. So I think it's important we understand that what we are doing is a response to the confusion and fear and anger and suffering in the world. So before I return to the teaching of the Chinese Zen master Taohui, does anybody have any questions about the practice? I know there's some new people here, newer people here. Any questions about the practice that we do here, the sitting, the walking practice, mindfulness practice? Or more importantly, as importantly, any questions about how to bring the practice into your daily life, to deal with the issues that you're facing and may be struggling with? So does anybody have any questions? Don't be shy, yes. Yeah, the equality complex. Yeah, most people thought they had enough problems just dealing with the superiority and the inferiority. Now they know that there was a third complex they didn't even know they had, right? Yeah. So again, that in Buddhist psychology, you know, the fundamental kind of cause of our suffering is egocentricity, narcissism, self-centeredness. And that self, that ego, can take various stances in the world, right? It can take a stance of, I'm better than, right? I'm exceptional. I deserve more. You know what I mean? I'm better more. I'm higher than. Right? So we can take that superiority complex. Some people, because of causes and conditions in their life, take the inferiority complex. I'm less than. Everyone's better than me, smarter than me, more luckier than me, have more advantages than me, et cetera, et cetera. So some people, their self is formed rather than around superiority. It's formed around inferiority, less than. And then the third complex, this equality complex, is an interesting complex. When I first heard it, I went, what? I'd never heard of that before. The equality complex. But what that means is it's that part of us that goes, I'm as good as everybody else. You know, why should they be first in line? I'm as good as them, right? Or why should John be up there inviting the bell? I mean, I can invite the bell as well as him. I could probably even do a better job. How come better? You know, it's that way. It's really that kind of that doesn't accept that there are differences, right? That some people are smarter than us. Some people are more talented to us. Some people, for whatever reason, get to hit the bell, and I don't. You know what I mean? And I'm not in that place of jealousy or so. It's usually defined as, you know, I am neither better than everyone. I am neither less than everyone. But nor am I equal to everyone. I mean, we're all different, and we have different capacities, and so that's those who suffer from the equality complex. So I hope I haven't made your life more difficult for those who are. Yeah. Again, it's really it's just understanding how our identification with a certain self, a certain ego, chooses us to take stances in relationship to the world and everyone else. And obviously, in our practice, we want to be free of that, that we don't have to take any stance, right? We can just interact with people freely without any sense of a self that stands apart from it, from everyone else or the life, thinking I'm better than, worse than, or I'm as good as everybody. You know, we want to free ourselves of all that nonsense, all that made-up stuff, or stuff that people made up for us, that we bought into. Buddhism is a interesting psychology as opposed to Western psychology, which is based on self. Buddhist psychology is based on non-self, which is for those of us in the West who grew up with it sounds one step away from psychosis or something, but it's really very meaningful because it really delineates that which we perceive as solid and real, which means myself, is really more just a designation, an identification, a convenience, right, of handling legal matters or responding when you're called and stuff like that. Or it certainly has a kind of a functional self has a functional role to play in our life. But if you look deeply and try to find some entity within your body mind that stands apart from your experience and says, all my experience belongs to me, my body belongs to me, that which claims, right? I think you will find cannot be found. It seems to be there, but upon investigation, it cannot be found. Right? That's profound. Because then one realizes these stances one's taken in life, either through, you know, better than, worse than, equal than, is really based on a fundamental fallacy, which is very liberating. I can just be. Right? I don't have to stand apart from other people. I don't have to hold on to a separate identity. It's much easier to flow in life without the burden of a strongly defined, held self. Anyhow, it's something worth investigating. And Buddhist meditators end up spending a lot of time investigating this matter of self. Any other question in terms of your life and your practice? Yes. And your name is?
My name is Candy.
Candy, yes, Candy.
Could you talk a little bit about bringing the practice to your daily life? I have trouble. The more I feel like I need it, the harder it is for me to practice mindfulness.
Okay, so just help me. What is the it that you would like to bring more into your daily life?
Mindfulness.
And when you say mindfulness, what do you mean?
I think of it as awareness mm-hmm. without compulsive thought or I think about it as when I felt the best about it, it was a transcending kind of
when you were able to be mindful.
When I felt like I was
conscious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was a transcending thing. And mm-hmm. when I'm stressful or tired or hungry, or it's very difficult for me to practice.
Well, it shouldn't be, okay? Because all these things, in other words, mindfulness just means what? Mindfulness means I am aware of what is present. I'm aware of what is happening. I'm aware of what's going on right now. You know, to be mindful that you're hungry, mindfulness reveals to you that you're hungry. Mindfulness reveals to you that you're tired. Mindfulness reveals to you that you're stressed. Right? So it's not like mindfulness is something that exists outside of life. Mindfulness is right there to shine on your life so you can see clearly what's going on. To be unconscious is to be tired, hungry, sleepy, grumpy, and just going through all that and acting out and not being mindful of what's going on. Right? So mindfulness is something that can occur no matter what's going on because it shines the light. Now, there are other things that have to go on beside mindfulness, right? Such as compassion. So when mindfulness revealed that Candy is stressed, Candy is tired, Candy is hungry, i.e. all those are called sufferings, that your compassion for Candy, your caring for Candy, moves you to do something to help her, right? In the same way, you may be, with somebody who is stressed, tired, angry, whatever, and your mindfulness reveals, see, when we're not mindful, we could just react, right? We could get angry back at them, right? Or we could get hurt. But the mindfulness reveals more clearly what's going on. There's something bothering them. Right? They have anger in them. They're suffering. Right? Mindfulness, again, is not enough. Right? Mindfulness, again, as I've often said, in the dark room, mindfulness turns on the light. Right? But whatever the light, when the light turns on, you're going to have to deal with it. Right? If you turn on the light and the room is filthy, you still may have to clean it. Right? I mean, mindfulness doesn't just, if you just stop and go, my house is filthy. Oh, I'm mindful of that. Well, that at least points you in the right direction. But there has to be action. And so, our practice, is to learn to act in a wise and compassionate way in this life. This is the practice, too. It's not just to be mindful. Does that make sense? So it's a developing these other capacities. Compassion, loving kindness, patience, right? Generosity, learning to give and respond and be of service to others and to ourselves. And so the practice is more than mindfulness, but mindfulness, we could say, is the basis because it turns on the light. It lets me see what's going on around me, in other people, within myself. Right? I know, there's anger in me, or there's fear in me, or there's sadness in me, or there's need in me, or there's, equality in me, or inferiority, or superiority. You know what I mean? I'm aware of all those things as they're arising, but then I have to take care of those parts of me. But please, when I was in Naples last week, someone was asking a question, and she was talking about going through her day and getting really angry at somebody, and she kind of put it on her list that when she got home that night and went to do her meditation, she would deal with her anger. I said to her, "No, that's not the practice. Right then and there, when you're aware that you're angry, stop and be present to your anger and see what's going on, and in that moment, transform." Right, I mean, the transformation comes in our life. It doesn't come, at some future point when we're on the cushion and somehow like that's going to save us. Even if you get it together on your cushion, you're still going to have to go back to work the next day. Right. So again, don't see your mindfulness as something that exists outside of everything that's arising in your life. Right. And if you blow it, that's okay. As soon as you're aware that you blow it, you've blown it, that's mindfulness. You see, that's mindfulness. Right? To even say, "I just missed an opportunity for mindfulness," that's being mindful. And in that moment, you can do it differently. You can start over. Yeah. Does that make sense? So it's not a pass-fail or success-failure kind of thing. It's just ongoing. And you're just trying to be more and more awake, more and more conscious, more and more aware, more and more mindful. And it's not, like just a straight line. It just keeps, it's back and forth, back and forth. But hopefully over time, months, years, you can see that the trajectory is toward more conscious living, more awareness, where the things that arise, the situations that arise with around us and within us are more and more met with mindful awareness. So we become, we're not reacting all the time. Right? We're not caught in the drama all the time. Right? But we see what's going on. I see what's going on. Breath, smile. It's okay. Just because I have a feeling in me, just because a thought arises in me, just because I have an impulse in me, I don't have to act on it, do I? I can just hold that in mindfulness. I can just hold that in awareness. Right? And I can choose whether to act or not to act. Right? That's freedom, isn't it? I can choose. But if all you can do is just react according to your old scripts and, you know, reactive patterns, there's no freedom in that. That's slavery. We're in servitude to our conditioning. We're in servitude to our past. We're in servitude to our mental formations. There's no freedom in that. There's no liberation in that. And we know in Buddhism is about freedom, about liberation. But don't turn it into everything with capitals. You know, liberation, capital L, capital I, like it's some, you know, state way out there that one day, you know, right, I'll get there. Right now, every day, we all have the capacity to liberate ourselves. Right? We go through our day when we get caught up, when we get stuck, when we go down those well-worn paths, you know, those patterns which we know so well. And if all of a sudden we can see it, I see what I'm doing. And we can just let it go. I don't have to go down that road. In that moment, we've liberated ourselves, haven't we? It doesn't mean, 10 minutes later we won't be at it again, right? But again, we liberate ourselves. And over time, we do begin to get it. But it takes that kind of consistent practice. So we have to, push it, but we have to be patient. It's kind of a little bit of a paradox. There has to be intention, there has to be effort, there has to be a desire for change and transformation. But on the other hand, there has to be an understanding that it's, there's no silver bullet, it's not going to happen overnight. I have to be patient with myself, we don't want to become, too forceful and impatient, but then we don't want to become too complacent. It's again, finding that balance. Any other questions? So again, we're reading from Swampland Flowers, this 12th century Chinese Chan Zen master. And we know this is a collection of letters. And we see, even though he's a monk, a master, lives in a monastery, most of his letters are from lay people, people like us, people in the world. They work, they have families. And again, because he lived away from them, they probably didn't get to see him very often at all. And they primarily communicated through letters. And they would write him a letter describing their practice, what's going on, their questions, and then he would write back to them. So this is a letter to his disciple called Zheng Tianyu. And he wrote, and this is the master Tahui writing, "Having read your letter carefully, I have come to know that you are unremitting in your conduct, that you are not carried away by the press of official duties, that in the midst of swift-flowing streams, you vigorously examine yourself. Far from being lax, Your aspiration to the path grows even more firm as time goes by. You have fulfilled my humble wishes solidly and profoundly. So he's praising this student, this disciple of his. And obviously this person is a bureaucrat, an official in the government. And he says to him that even though you are stressed, he calls it here the press of official duties, even though you're very busy, you're not carried away by this press of official duties. You are unremitting in your conduct, that in the midst of swift-flowing streams, you vigorously examine yourself. Which is what we're just... I mean, this is what he's saying, right? Externally, things are happening in our life, right? Externally, for some of us, a lot may be happening in our life. We may have work that's very busy. We may have life a lot going on and stressful. We may have home and family situations, where there's a lot going on, right? And yet, he says, you are unremitting in your conduct. Now, what he means is that you have that your sense of how you are in the world, the way you conduct yourself in your relationships, is what? I don't know if I want to say it, because I wonder how many of us are that heedful about the way we conduct ourselves, you know? Do we have a standard in terms of how we relate consistently and how we conduct ourselves? We want to be honest people. We want to be authentic, right? We want to be positive and constructive. We want to be helpful. Right? How do we conduct ourselves in the world? How do we conduct ourselves in relationships? Right? Whether these are at work, whether we're at the store, whether we're at home with family, whether we're with friends, right? Is there a consistency in how we conduct ourselves? Is that clear? That's important, isn't it? Because if not, we are easily just swept away. And our ego needs at the moment, wanting to be liked, wanting to be loved, wanting to be thought highly of, wanting to control, wanting to, you know, all those kinds of things will contaminate relationships, as opposed to a sense of, again, how you want to be in the world, in all your relationships. How you want to, again, conduct is an interesting word. But it's not I conduct myself based on some kind of external standards that are imposed on me or that I figure out will get me something. You know, if I conduct myself in this way, then I'll probably get a good mark, or I'll probably get a good recommendation, or I'll stay low and I won't cause any trouble and no, you know what I'm saying? But it's a kind of inner kind of authenticity about how you want to be in the world that you're true to, no matter what the circumstances are. Again, you do not get carried away. When we talk about stress, we're talking about what? That the pressing duties of our life are carrying us away. We lose our center. We lose our ground. We lose that inner sense of stability and calmness, right? And we are now at the external parts of ourselves. We're out here, and we're just lost in the activity. We're lost in the drama. We're lost in the emotionality, right? We're not at a deeper place going through it all, but not being swept away by it. Is that clear? And that's, in a certain way, when we're meditating, that's what we're learning how to do, right? You know, we're not learning, your question about daily life is important. We do not spend our life sitting on the cushion and walking, you know, around and around in front of somebody else with our eyes down. I mean, is there anybody here that's kind of how they spend their life? No. Our life is, right? So, you know, we have to learn from what we do here in the cushion and what we, you know, do in our formal meditation to be able to take it into our life so we can do it in our life. So when we sit, right? When we sit in stability, when we sit without moving, it doesn't mean that inside thoughts, feelings, perceptions, dramas are not arising in us. Is that true? All right. But what we are doing is we are not reacting, or we're learning not to react. We're learning to watch in mindfulness, be aware of the thoughts, feelings, emotions as they arise. We're holding them in mindfulness and then just either letting them go or just taking good care of them, right? So they don't disturb us. Now, we want to be able to learn how to take that same mind state throughout the day. So we have that same center, that same calmness, that same stability. So as things arise and pass away within us or outside us, we're not swept away. Right? I mean, people are not, when we're sitting here, getting up, sitting down, and, you know, we don't hear people, right? Because we're what? We're not being swept away by this stuff the way we would in our normal everyday lives. So this is what we're learning here. We don't want to get swept away by life. Yes?
What's the difference between what you're saying, using the expression getting swept away, and the notion of getting absorbed into something, so that whatever the task is you're doing, you're absorbed and everything around you falls away? What's the difference between that and getting swept away?
Well, if I said to you, Barbara, what is the difference between swimming in the ocean and swimming along the way you want to swim, and all of a sudden the waves are so powerful that they are taking you where they want to go? What's the difference? So it's like that. So when you're absorbed in something, you know, you're saying there's a task at hand, whatever you're doing, That's an absorption in which you are consciously giving yourself. The swept away implies something else is sweeping you away from that place of absorption, and you're just being pulled, either being pulled by externals or being pulled by some kind of emotional response, but you're not at that place of stable absorption. Right. That place of oneness and absorption is a place that we want to be. We want to be able to go through our life totally absorbed in whatever task is right before us. Right? You're right. But the sweeping away means we are here, we're there. So that's a good question. And in the midst of the swiftly flowing streams, we're vigorously examining ourselves, which is, again, that sense of whatever I'm doing, I'm aware of what's going on inside me. Examining myself means I am what? I'm just kind of doing a mental checkup. I know what's going on inside me. And I'm making adjustments as need be. So I don't get swept away. So I don't get overwhelmed. So I don't get emotionally bent out of shape. So I don't get stressed out. Right? So I don't continue to go down communication paths or other kinds of paths that only lead to trouble. Right? We all know that, don't we? I mean, isn't it good if you can be having a conversation with somebody or in Tadaksya and it starts going bad and you just go, what? This is not going where I want it to go. Why don't we just stop? Wouldn't that be wonderful, right? Why don't we just stop? Yeah, I want to, you know, we want to talk constructively with one another. Right? We don't want to be blaming, right? Casting aspersion, finding fault, creating more suffering. Why don't we just stop? That can only come from some kind of self-awareness, right? That as you're moving through your stream of life and daily life, at the same time, there's a part of you that's aware, that's examining. You know, it's maybe 10 or 15%, right? I mean, you can still be living your life. It's not like you're gonna, right, you're just totally self-absorbed. It means, you know, you're going through your day, you're absorbed in what you're doing, but there's a part of you that is aware. That's mindful, that's self-aware, so you can see, right, when things are starting to go off. I'm getting stressed. I'm getting a little bent out of shape here. Getting a little overwhelmed here. This interaction is not going where I was hoping it was going to go. This conversation is not, you know what I mean? And you just, oh. Right? I can just stop. So this practitioner is getting praised by his teacher for that. So he says, nevertheless, so after he's praising him, he says, nevertheless, worldly passions are like a blazing fire. When will they ever end? That's a good question. We don't know when they'll ever end, right? But we can hope that if we are vigilant, right, that when they begin to blaze up, we know how to what? We know at least how not to throw more gasoline on the fire, right? I mean, that's a good beginning, isn't it? Right? And then as we get better, we may learn to, you know, have appropriate water or fire extinguisher to know how to put them out quickly, right? And even better, over time, we may be learning how not even to cause them to blaze up, right? That's like a deeper practice. In the beginning, we're just, you know, just to be aware that things are beginning to blaze, beginning to aware that, you know, a little gasoline is being thrown in the fire, I don't need to, being aware that I can put it out. But over time, we want our practice to deepen that the blazing isn't going on. So he says, right in the midst of all the activity, in the midst of the hubbub, you mustn't forget the business of the bamboo chair and the reed cushion. That means meditation. He says, usually when we meditate, we set our mind on a still concentration point, such as when we're here, we focus, let's say, on the breath. Right? We try to find a point. In this case, the body breathing, the in-breath and the out-breath, and make that the point of concentration. He says, so usually in formal meditation, we set our mind on this still concentration point, but you must also be able to use it right in the midst of the hubbub. If you have no strength amidst commotion, after all, it's as if you have never made any effort in stillness. Is this clear? So this is a Zen master teaching, not monks in a silent retreat, not people living, you know, out in the country, leading an idyllic, quiet, pastoral life, right? This is a Zen master talking to people like us, saying, you know, you're in the commotion. If you only learn how to still your life, still your mind, still your emotions when you're on the cushion, he says, all your efforts of meditation will be for nil. You have to learn how to still your mind in the midst of activity. Would anybody disagree with it? Does anybody think that's not possible? I'm sure there's some people who think that's, Fred, if you only knew my life, impossible. Anybody here want to say that? Nobody will admit to that. But I would imagine, secretly, there are probably many of us here who believe that. You know, we're the exception, right? We're the exception. 12th century, right? Feudal China, same problems. I mean, you know, this should make you realize, you know, it's externally it's changed, but people are still dealing with the same issues. Same kind of advice, right? The Mandarin official in 12th century China and, the active person today still, right, is getting swept away by the commotion of life, by the commotion of their feelings. And then he quotes Vimalakirti. Vimalakirti is quite a well-known Buddhist teacher from ancient China. Vimalakirti, he was a layman, so he was quite well-known. Vimalakirti said, it's like this. The high plateau does not produce lotus flowers. It is the mire of the low swamplands that produces these flowers. Where are you going to learn it? Right? I mean, where are we going to learn not to be swept away other than in situations where we get swept away? This is important, you know, because many of us, and sometimes because it's a lot of the traditional Buddhist teachings or other types of Eastern teachings were given by teachers often to monastics or hermits or people in retreat. There's a sense of, you know, idyllic, quiet, still kind of life, you know. And that's where we want to get to. But he says the high plateau, you know, means like, you know, that place of ideal stillness and quiet and peace and, you know, idyllic pastoral kind of setting. He said, you know, that's not where the lotus. Lotus is the most beautiful flower. It doesn't grow there. It grows in the mud. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, no mud, no lotus. It's a calligraphy he does. No mud, no lotus. I actually have that calligraphy at my home, and many people go, what does that mean? When they say, I mean, people aren't familiar with Buddhism. No mud, no lotus. Mud is all the yuck, is all the muck. Mud is our delusions. Muck is our anger, our fear. Muck is our egocentricity. Muck is our hurt. Muck is our darkness. Muck is, right? All that and more, right? That's the mud. Right? The mud is something we don't like. Right? But no mud, no lotus. Right? The lotus is what? What? Insight, understanding, intelligence, wisdom, compassion, patience, loving kindness, etc., etc., etc. Mindfulness, calmness, peace of mind, right? Those are the flowers. It's only out of this other stuff that the yearning comes about, doesn't it? And it also, that's what feeds it. That's what transforms us. Right? How will we learn to be conscious people other than in the midst of unconsciousness? Right? How are we going to learn to be happy people other than we have to come out of unhappiness? Right? How do we learn to be selfless people other than we have to come out of our selfishness, right? Does that make sense? So that's the mud is actually the fertile ground that will facilitate our transformation. So that's why, you know, it's not like no mud, you know, get rid of the mud. Then we'll have lotuses, right? No mud, no lotus. It's the same calligraphy with the circle. So we're grateful to the mud, right? We're grateful to our darkness. We're grateful to our suffering because it, when seen clearly, it has the power to inspire us to transformation. But the transformation is going to come only within the mud. When we act unkindly and we're conscious, which means we see what we're doing, we see the suffering that causes another, we see how it's coming from an unhealthy part in ourselves, in that moment of insight and mindfulness and insight comes what? The inspiration to transform, to do it differently. Right? That's why, again, mindfulness turns on the light. But there's still more to do. So any questions about this? Questions meaning that it doesn't make sense or you're not clear how to bring it into your daily life. I mean, is everybody clear how starting now they're going to deal with the commotion? How if you think every day you get up with a good intention, but then you get swept away and the next thing you know it's 8 o'clock at night and you're crawling around somewhere, defeated once again? Do you think you have a better handle on it tonight? Yes.
Yeah, I know one of the things I tend to struggle with is being influenced by the people around me very strongly. And when I can surround myself with positive, wonderful people, I become much more positive and much more mindful and much more able to catch myself on the way. Yeah. It's all very wonderful. Unfortunately, not everyone is that way.
Yeah.
And allowing myself, and I work very closely with some people that I'm noticing are more and more negative. And I find myself now, thankfully, I'm recognizing that I'm going down this path of negativity, and I'm catching an hour later, I shouldn't have said that. That was really negative and it didn't contribute. But it's a delayed mindfulness, so I'm not catching myself in the moment, which means I can't fix it that moment. But then the other issue is I know I'm letting myself be influenced too much by the externals, the surroundings, and how to stop that, despite the fact that those surroundings are there and they're going to be very close and very much a part of life. But luck is, instead of me growing up,
in ancient times, or even to today, that's why people went off and became monks and nuns, you know, because you just get out of the environment. It's so much easier, right? You know, get away from all those negative people, you know, get around. But again, if you go to a monastery, you realize, you know, it's not full of saints either. So sometimes that could be a little bit of an illusion. But that's our challenge. It's not to say that, you know, we're the only good people. There are lots of good people. But in a certain way, you know, a lot of the workplaces, you know, a lot of negativity, a lot of gossip, a lot of backbiting, a lot of, you know, and that's just the culture, right? And I think that's why, first thing he says, you know, from your letter, it sounds like your conduct is impeccable, which means, you know, Kate, that you kind of have your own inner standard of how you, you know, in terms of your own communication, in terms of your own speech. And when people come to you to gossip or talk negatively to other people, I think that's a real issue. I know when I used to, you know, work in settings with normal people, you know, that's always an issue. And, you know, it for me, again, you know, the lotus blooms in the mud. I mean, it made me want to be stronger, you know, because I was more conscious that, you know, I didn't want to go down this path. I didn't want to invade, you know, be involved in those conversations. And what I found over time was people who like the gossip, people who like the backbite, when they realize that you're not interested in that. In other words, you know, it's not like you, you know, dismiss them, but you just don't give any feedback. You know, people who like to spread gossip, you know, like to know that it's working. You know, so if you're just, you know, you just don't, you know, you just, or else, you know, what I used to do a lot was talk about the positive qualities of that person. I mean, that would shut them right up. you know what I mean? Or try to show the other side, or try to show some understanding. I mean, it's, you know, they realize, let me talk to somebody else in the lunchroom. Fred's not fun. Well, most of our thoughts we get from somewhere. You're right.
I guess it's like creating a letting go of it. I don't know what it is. Something I'm just becoming.
Well, I think it's, again, I think because most of us do not work or often, you know, still in our families or friendship circles or extended families, you know, especially as we begin to change or see things differently, you know, we may be aware of the differences. You know, around the holidays, you spend more time with your family, you often notice things like that. Again, you know, we're not here to leave the world. You know, we are in the world, we are in these families, we are in these work situations, and in a certain way, we need a stronger practice than the monks and the nuns who are in much more controlled environments. But that means our practice can actually become stronger and deeper because we have to be so much stronger. You know, I think you're just acknowledging that that in terms of, let's say, you know, your deep listening and your communication, that you probably need to have much, you know, go about your day with much more intention, which means to set your intention in the morning before, you know, when you know what you're going to work and really, you know, do your best to maintain it during the day. Right. Because you're right. You know, negativity is very powerful, too. Right. And if we're not as strong in our practice, and if we are more influenced, it can get inside us. Again, that's another reason to come to Sangha, you know, another reason to, you know, come to events like this or with other kind of communities. You know, if you're not getting it a lot in your work life or this and that, you know, try to get it where you can. Because that just waters those seeds. You know, we talk in the practice about watering seeds. And what you're saying, a lot of times at the work situation, you know, seeds of negativity are getting watered. So you want to, you know, put your, you know, again, you want to do as much self-watering as you can. But you also want to put yourself in environments when you can around people or situations or through your readings or whatever, you know, that water those positive seeds. And you have to, you obviously realize I got to be much, you know, I have to take this more seriously, because you realize if I don't, I mean, serious doesn't mean like, you know, rigid serious, but if I'm not careful, just unconsciously, I can get very well influenced in certain ways. And we all know that. Again, you know, swept away is a wonderful, right, you know, phrase. It means we get, you know, I'm meaning to swim here, but some wave came along. Before I knew it, I'm swept to where I don't want to be. Right, and that implies that, you know, I know where I want to be. I'm doing my best not to get swept away, but when I do get swept away, I know that I've been swept away, and I come back. But again, you know, you have the opportunity of developing a strong practice. You got to keep practicing, but again, you know, but just be more, you know, but just be a lot more compassionate. And the other thing is, you know, again, I guess what I was just sharing a little bit of my own example is, you don't have to go along with it. It doesn't mean you have to, you know, tell everybody what you really think of them and call them names and tell them, you know, you're a gossip and a backbiter. You know what I mean? I mean, maybe at some point you need to do that. But generally it just means, you know, you just let people know that, you know, I'm not interested in having those kind of conversations. They're not helpful. And then you could, you know, try to induce another kind of conversation. Which is a way of right there in the situation of not getting swept away, because you are clear about, you know, the kind of conversations you have to be, or the way you want to talk about people, and right? I mean, you're a teacher. And we know that, I'm sure, in your interactions with your children, your students, you are very conscious of how you communicate with them and what seeds you are watering in them. Right? You know what I'm saying? It's interesting, but then we go to the lunchroom or the, you know, and it's like it's all of a sudden we forget about that. When we really, we shouldn't. It's the same thing. You know, that's where he says about your conduct being impeccable. It means like wherever you go, you know, you're watering positive seeds. You're watering positive seeds in your students, you're watering positive seeds in your fellow teachers, you know, and you're not watering negative seeds. And including in yourself. Last question that we should
have. Very short question.
Okay.
In the same sort of environment,
yeah,
are there times when an environment may be oppressive and you're watering seeds of humor?
Oh, yeah, lots of.
With the criticism, though. So there's criticism involved in a way. But it's the humor that's lifting people out of the feeling oppressed.
You mean you're saying that you might be doing in those kind of environments,
yes,
or somebody could be doing? Yeah. I mean, that's what I was trying to say. I mean, we could go on and on, but yeah, we want to. It doesn't mean necessarily that we have to turn our back on it, but we can deal with these situations in a creative way where somehow we turn it around, right? Just because somebody is wanting to dance with us in a certain way, we don't have to, you know, we can spin out or something, or, you know, they want to go left and you turn right. You know, then see what happens. Or, you know, humor, yeah. Changing the subject. You know, there are lots of ways to deal with it. You know, we don't have to give in to toxic environments, do we? No. And again, you know, there may be nothing we can do, I mean, but... I mean, you know, again, we want to transform the world, don't we? And, you know, that's sounds great, doesn't it? But we don't realize that there are lots of little opportunities throughout our day and lots of little interactions where we have the opportunities in this little interaction to do something a little different, you know, to make contact with a stranger, or somebody you're just dealing with on a kind of business or a functional way, and all of a sudden, you know, you make a human contact with them. You make a connection. You try to find out about them, who they are, what's going on with them. Right? There's a little, you know, there's an opportunity. There's a lot more opportunity in life, or in like we're talking about, you know. Just to... Because, again, a lot of times negative people like that are also... They don't realize how caught up they are in that way of thinking. You know what I mean? And how it's causing suffering to them. We expect great things from you, Kate, out there. Okay, thank you. So thank you all for coming. Most people, I think, know about this Saturday. We're having a movie night
at the Lotus Pond, which is connected here, and we're showing this really wonderful documentary called The Dahmer Brothers. I think there's information on our website. I certainly encourage you to come. You can register or just sign up. It's not really registering on our website, just so we know how many are coming. But it's a wonderful documentary about a 10-day meditation course that was given at a maximum security prison in Alabama. And it's unbelievable what goes on and the transformation that occurs with these rough characters who end up not so rough at the end. Anyhow, it's really wonderful. So that's at the Lotus Pond Saturday at 7:00, and bring friends, family. I mean, it's open to everyone. But just so we know, because we're going to be providing some desserts and stuff, if you are going to come.